Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated June 22nd. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's front page, top of the fold, bankrupt connections, $550 million withers to $20 million. Connections Technologies spent more than $550 million in the past 10 years trying to develop its business plan by building fiber optic networks across the nation. On June 14th, a U.S. bankruptcy judge in Delaware approved the sale of almost all of the telecom's assets for about $20 million, perhaps closing the final chapter to what many call the biggest private company bankruptcy in the Triangle's history. Connection was started by former Cary Mayor Glenn Lang. And just as the judge signed the order, the $453 million investment made in Connection by Reedy Creek Investments was gone. Reedy Creek's investors include SAS co-founders Jim Goodnight and John Saul. Also, mostly gone is the $105 million investment made by a trio of banks, Germany's UniCredit at $75 million, Bank of America at $15 million, and Raleigh's Capital Bank, $15 million. As secured priority creditors, the banks get the $20 million proceeds from the fire sale. Connections assets primarily include the fiber optic cables that the company laid across the country. Connection, its parent company, Capital Broadband, LLC, and other affiliates are expected to begin shutting down the Cary headquarters on June 22nd, where 89 employees remain, according to a letter received by the North Department of Commerce from Capital Broadband. At its peak, Connection had about 350 employees in Cary and more than 600 people nationwide. Hotwire Communications of Wynnewood, Pennsylvania, was a successful bidder for the majority of Connection's assets in 48 states across the country, says Matt Springer, Executive Vice President of Corporate Development for Connection. Hotwire paid about $16 million for about 140 properties owned by Connection, according to the court filings. The sale was expected to be finalized on June 21st. Hotwire is expected to hire at least 40 of Connection's employees in Cary, Lank stated in a June 19 letter to the North Carolina Department of Commerce. Springer says Connection still has between 130 and 140 employees nationwide, most of whom are expected to be retained by Hotwire. A representative of Hotwire did not return calls for comment. Mediacom of New York also is buying assets that Connection affiliates owned in Alabama and North Florida. Attorneys say the company paid about $2 million for the assets. We were interested in the Connection assets because we already have a large subscriber base in Florida and Alabama, says Tom Larson, Group Vice President for Legal and Public Affairs at Mediacom. The properties are adjacent to our existing cable system, which will allow Mediacom to quickly connect these new customers to our national fiber network and improve the quality of their communications services. Connection's assets in the Laguna Woods Village community in Southern California were sold to Golden Rain Foundation, a group representing the Laguna Woods residents, for about $1 million. As of the Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing in late April, Connection had 102,460 video customers in 48 states. It had $69 million in revenue in 2011. But the company's business model relied heavily on the construction of new housing communities. Connection would install and operate cable television internet services at newly constructed residential communities and multifamily housing projects. But with a 2008 slowdown in the housing market, developers in many of the communities scaled back or canceled projects. After that, the company tried changing its focus to work directly with companies such as Dish TV and manufactured housing communities. But that move was not enough to save the company. Next up, smaller P&C insurers gnaw at giant's share, by Chris Bagley. from Raleigh. Several mid-sized companies have eaten into the local market share of giant property and casualty insurers in the last few years, putting names like Erie and North Carolina Farm Bureau Mutual alongside the likes of Nationwide, State Farm, and Travelers. Nationwide remains the largest P&C insurer in the state, with a total of about $1.2 billion in premiums written in 2011. According to a Triangle Business Journal analysis of data released in early June by the North Carolina Department of Insurance, State Farm continues to lead in several categories of insurance, including homeowners insurance, and Travelers remains a top insurer of commercial buildings and several other lines. But none of those companies' P&C insurance lines have grown substantially in North Carolina since 2005, according to the analysis. Their diminished dominance in some business lines could help stimulate competition as more insurers lure customers' attentions. State Insurance Commissioner Wayne Goodwin says several lines of insurance business, including auto insurance, are served by half again as many carriers as there were a couple of years ago. Even with the ups and downs, auto insurance is still a successful and productive and competitive money-making venture, Goodwin says. There are carriers falling all over each other to come here. One making inroads is Pennsylvania-based Erie Insurance Company, which has made a push in North Carolina in recent years. The company wrote $296 million in direct premiums in the state last year, up by 35% from 2005, according to state data. Erie's Raleigh branch manager, Chris Marion, credits the company's growth partly to stepped-up marketing efforts, such as advertising, and redoubled efforts to offer defensive driving classes to drivers of the fleets it insures. Erie has also grown into North Carolina's third-largest insurer of commercial buildings, behind the Cincinnati Insurance Company and Travelers. The North Carolina Farm Bureau's property and casualty business has also grown substantially, by 21%, since 2005, overtaking State Farm as the state's second-largest insurer in that category. Its mutual insurance arm wrote $935 million in premiums last year. Roger Batdorf, a manager in the actuarial department of the Raleigh Bureau, says the Farm Bureau bolsters its large car and home insurance lines by offering discounts to customers who use both. Like Erie, the Farm Bureau has grown as an insurer of commercial buildings at a time when most other insurers are writing fewer and smaller policies. In fact, the markets for liability insurance on commercial buildings, manufactured products, passenger cars, and commercial vehicle fleets have all shrunk steadily since 2005 in terms of total premiums written, according to the DOI's figures. That shrinkage is directly tied to the economy, says David Marlette, who heads the Department of Finance, Banking and Insurance at Appalachian State University's Business School. While the markets for most other types of insurance have begun to expand again, liability insurance is generally tied to metrics such as payroll size and product sales, which tend to lag by a year or more, Marlette says. Nationwide's and State Farm's loss of market share in some business lines in North Carolina parallels the nation as a whole, according to AM Best Company, an insurance rating agency. National data provided by AM Best's Jim Peavy show the two companies each losing about a third of a percentage point between 2007 and 2011, contrasting with gains of similar size by both Erie and Travelers. This week's lead article, Market Share Jostle. Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina and United own 60% of health insurance business. By Jason DeBrun from Chapel Hill. One health insurance provider continues to drive the bus in North Carolina, and the top two in the state combined for nearly 60% of the group market share. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina wrote nearly $5 billion in direct premiums in 2011. Combined with United Healthcare Group's $2.15 billion in premiums, the two insurers provided more health insurance coverage in the state than the remaining companies combined. These market share figures exclude those on the government-sponsored programs Medicare and Medicaid. A knee-jerk reaction to the data could indicate reduced competition and trouble for consumers. Indeed, top executives at Aetna and WellPath, which both have small market shares, say as much. Consumers need to have a choice in who is managing their health benefits, says Maggie Maxwell. Margie Maxwell, Aetna's president of Southeast Markets. A more nuanced look at the realities of the market, however, could portend something better for consumers. Hospitals and physician practices are consolidating into large healthcare systems around the state, with some analysts estimating that by 2020, nearly all healthcare providers will be under one of five or six major health system umbrellas. When a health system grows that large, it swings major bargaining power at the negotiating table with insurance companies. Health providers and insurance companies agree on what price the insurance provider will pay for various procedures. When an agreement can't be reached, that health system becomes an out-of-network provider, typically with higher charges to the patient. If a health insurer can't agree on a reimbursement rate with a major hospital system, the insurance provider can see its customers switch insurance carriers. If an insurance provider can't afford to walk away from the negotiating table, then the hospital system can command a higher reimbursement rate for procedures, a cost ultimately passed on to the patient. When the tables are reversed, however, the insurance provider has stronger bargaining power because of the large number of patients it covers. A hospital that couldn't reach an agreement with such a big insurance provider would be in danger of being out of network for a large portion of the population, which would cost the hospital customers. If you want hospital prices to come down, you want strong insurance companies, says Dr. Peter Ubel, a professor at Duke University. Looking specifically at the insurance market, Garland Scott, CEO of United Healthcare of the Carolinas, touts his company's offerings as a driver for increased business. He points especially to the new multi-choice program that allows small employers to offer up to 31 plans to employees. Traditionally, a small business would have to choose only one plan from a provider to offer its employees. That can be difficult, especially when employees have vastly different health needs. United Healthcare's MultiChoice, however, allows even small employers to offer a full range of plans, including high or low deductible plans, or others arranged like health savings accounts. While existing United Healthcare customers like the new option, it's in attracting new customers that the plan has shown its true value. Some 75% of companies signing up for MultiChoice are new to United Healthcare. Scott says United has even larger market share in managing self-insured programs, but data for that category is not publicly available. Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina controls nearly the entire market for selling health insurance on an individual basis, which is a different market than selling group plans like those offered through an employer. Brad Wilson, CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina, says the locally based insurer has exploded market share by being good at the blocking and tackling. By that he means doing the basics right. Looking ahead, he says wellness programs through employers will be the next major transition for insurance plans. These programs encourage healthy living and promise to reduce health costs. From my personal point of view, it could be happening faster, Wilson says, of getting these programs in the market, but adds they are making inroads with these offerings. Next up, EMC Cisco Venture plots growth locally. By Lauren K. Ensange from Durham. Virtual Computing Environment Company, a joint venture of Cisco Systems and EMC Corporation that sells IT hardware and software, plans to double its Triangle workforce in an expansion that would create dozens of new local jobs. VCE chose Richardson, Texas for its headquarters in 2011, vowing to create 434 jobs in the Dallas suburb, despite the pull of both its investors' presences in Research Triangle Park. But VCE wasn't about to ignore RTP completely. Vice President of Product Development Todd Pavone, who also oversees the RTP operations, says the company is looking to double the current staff of 50. and the company is preparing for that growth by investing in additional space. Until now, VCE was housed at a 5,000-square-foot temporary space, but the company just signed on to lease 31,000 square feet of office space in Durham. The space, previously occupied by iContact, will accommodate software development, but also will have a lab to showcase VCE's lead product, the V-Block system. VCE spokesman Rick LaCroix says the lab could host hundreds of prospective customers annually. Another such proof-of-concept lab outside of Boston opened in the fall and is already bringing in customers from all over the world. VCE has contracts with most of the major chains for hotel services for its guests, LaCroix says. Jay Cuthrell, who works in VCE's Office of the Chief Technology Officer, claims the V-Block is a one-stop unit for IT. To further the explanation, he compares V-Block infrastructure, which contains a server, network, and storage, to a sandwich. Some people buy slices of cheese, and then they go out and buy the meats, and the condiments, and the bread, and then put them together, he says. We're like a McDonald's, almost. We can really serve up the sandwiches for you. And the sandwiches star products from VCE primary investors, Cisco and EMC, says John Webster, a senior partner at analyst firm Evaluator Group. They're packaging them together in this concept, he says, adding that VCE exists to sell Cisco and EMC products. The selling point of V-Blocks are the integration and support of the packages, different from the do-it-yourself mantra IT companies have been employing for decades. It's VCE saying, we'll do the work for you, but there's a cost with that, Webster says, adding that V-Block and similar packages from the likes of IBM, Dell, and HP are starting to catch on. Typically, IT buying customers change their buying habits slowly. The new lab, which should be ready by October, will showcase V-Block's integrated concept to believers and non-believers alike. The RTP space will also be used to work on additional software to manage cloud data. Pavone says choosing RTP for the lab wasn't just about its proximity to EMC and Cisco. The presence of the universities makes the triangle ideal for hires, he says. Financial terms of VCE's triangle investment were not disclosed, but similar space at the same building on Meridian Parkway was listed by CBRE for about $630,000 a year. The move should be completed by August. California-based Cisco and Massachusetts-based EMC together employ more than 5,000 people in the RTP. Worldwide, VCE employs 1,000 people. In 2011, estimated revenue at VCE was in excess of $850 million, Pavone says. Continuing on, HTC to close Durham unit, by Lauren K. Ansange, from Durham. Taiwan-based smartphone maker HTC Corporation is closing its office in Durham, a move that likely will cost the area dozens of jobs and open up space in one of the Bull City's best-known commercial real estate properties. Spokeswoman Lori Rodney says employees were informed of the decision on June 20th. HTC conducts ongoing reviews of all aspects of its business and, as part of these reviews, believes this is an important step to help HTC maintain its competitive edge and ability to deliver quality innovations for consumers, reads a company response to a Triangle Business Journal inquiry. The company confirmed the closure will happen over the next several weeks, but could not provide a specific date. Management will be meeting with impacted staff members individually, and some will be able to relocate their positions or to work from home. Others will be laid off. HTC declined to say what the breakdown would be, but did confirm some of the local workforce of 50 would be losing their jobs. Then Chief Strategy Officer for HTC, Ron Lukes, had called Durham a perfect place to open our new R&D office in December of 2010. That's when HTC announced its plan to lease space for a new research and development office in downtown Durham. HTC planned to initially employ 45 people in its facility and grow further during 2011 and into the future. The city of Durham had even approved a $150,000 incentive offer if the company created 99 jobs and invested $2 million by 2014 in Durham. But that agreement was never signed, no incentive was ever issued, and even Luke's moved on to what HTC called other opportunities. The company had leased about 47,000 square feet in 2011 in two buildings at American Tobacco, enough space for 150 employees. HTC never moved workers into the second building, however. In May, HTC began marketing nearly two-thirds of its office space for sublease. The closure was news to downtown Durham President Bill Kalkoff, who helped push for HTC to open the facility. HTC was certainly something we were proud to be able to land in downtown Durham, he says. Anytime you lose a significant corporate presence like HTC, that's a blow. He says that HTC's space at American Tobacco will likely be easy to fill. But this is very disappointing for the folks that will be losing their jobs, he says. American Tobacco spokesman and GBW Strategies principal Billy Warden also hadn't been notified of the closure Wednesday. Typically, HTC is the one that comments about HTC, he said, adding that he would have to look into the issue before providing comment. The Durham location is one of three HTC research and development facilities in the United States. The other two are in Seattle and in San Francisco. Don Shoup and Heath Chapman with CBRE Raleigh, who represented HTC in the initial lease negotiations, could not be reached for comment. Next up, job squeeze. Law graduates struggle to find employment as firms reduce hiring. By Chris Bagley from Raleigh. Law firms have continued to cut back their hiring of first-year attorneys nationally, driving recent law graduates' unemployment rates to the highest levels in at least 17 years. While statistics suggest that the job market in the Triangle isn't quite as bad as in most other metro areas, the hiring window is narrowing for local graduates, just as it is for their peers nationwide. Of the 247 students who graduated from UNC Chapel Hill's Law School in May 2011, about 8% were still unemployed in February 2012, according to the American Bar Association. That's up from a year ago when about 6% of the class of 2010 was still unemployed in February 2011. The most recent unemployment rates rose to 14% for North Carolina Central University Law School and to 2% for Duke University, according to similar surveys. Only Campbell University's law school posted an improvement, with its jobless rate for recent grads falling to 8% from 16% the year before. Statistics from the schools, the ABA, and the National Association for Law Placement, a professional group, show hiring has slowed most dramatically for firms with more than 500 attorneys, only a handful of which have offices in the Triangle. Smaller firms, in-house legal departments, government agencies, and nonprofit groups have also cut hiring, albeit less dramatically. Firms that are hiring can draw from a stronger pool of candidates than they could 5 years ago, says Johnny Loper, managing partner for Womble Carlyle's Raleigh office. That office and Womble's Research Triangle Park office expect to hire two new associates in the fall after the two take the state bar exam, Loper says. Until 2008, competition for top talent had driven up starting salaries by several thousand dollars each year. The anemic job market since then has allowed local business-oriented firms to hold first-year associate salaries in the range of $120,000 and thus help the firms to accommodate their clients' new frugality. We've been fortunate enough with the firms we use to avoid any creep in billings over the last 3 or 4 years, said Matt Massery, general counsel for Cary-based Tower Company. Many corporate clients and several law firms have also begun to embrace alternate billing arrangements, such as fixed fees and performance bonuses. While the clients say their main goal is to make legal fees more predictable, some say they end up paying noticeably less under such alternative arrangements. Attorneys who launched the new firm Morningstar Law Group in Durham last week, including four partners who left Womble Carlyle, say one key motivation was wanting to be more flexible with clients on such arrangements. Numbers from the law schools suggest that Womble Carlyle's continued hiring is not typical. At Duke, UNC, and many of the other schools surveyed by the NALP, the sort of top graduates who used to go to giant high-paying firms are now going to firms of 100 to 500 attorneys. Many of the graduates are going to work for smaller firms, while still others are taking part-time jobs or jobs where law degrees, while advantageous, are not required. NALP said last week that fewer than half of recent grads with jobs were working for law firms, which tend to pay more than in-house legal departments and government agencies. That fraction had been below 50% only once since NALP began its annual survey. "We're still waiting for things to get back to normal," says Brian Lewis, Career Services Director for UNC Chapel Hill's Law School. "But we're not even sure they will ever get back to normal." Next up, Raleigh to build $16 million campus, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Raleigh. The city of Raleigh is getting ready to spend about $16 million to build a remote operations campus off Gresham Lake Road in North Raleigh that will be the first of five such centers planned over the next decade for its vehicle and heavy equipment fleets. But the so-called Northeast Remote Operations Facility will likely be the cheapest of the five centers because the city was able to buy three warehouse buildings at a discounted rate in 2009. Future phases are expected to be all new construction and much more expensive. Rich Kelly with Raleigh's Construction Management Division says construction bids will go out soon for the work on the Northeast Remote Operations Facilities, the biggest construction project started by the city in at least 2 years. All total, the campus will have about 142,000 square feet of building space and room to park dozens of heavy equipment vehicles and implements used for street repair, snow removal, and leaf collection, and other chores. The project will include the renovation of two warehouse buildings, demolition of another building, and construction of three smaller buildings, plus a fuel station for an estimated cost of $16 million. The city paid $6 million for the 19-acre site in late 2009. The purpose of the remote operations facilities, says City Manager Russell Allen, is to cut down on the travel time for the city's maintenance workers and to increase efficiency. Currently, almost all of the city's vehicles and heavy equipment are stored at a 17-acre landlocked site near the intersection of West and Peace Street in downtown Raleigh. These remote facilities, number one, replace very, very outdated and inadequate existing facilities, and number two, distribute the facilities geographically in a more efficient way for our operations versus a single location, he says. The city's shift from a centralized operations center to multiple remote facilities is the result of a 2005 report that looked into existing departments and staff, travel time, and cost impacts of that travel time. Allen says financing of the Northeast Remote Facility has been approved by the City Council using bond financing, but it was not part of a bond referendum. Raleigh city leaders have also authorized early design work to begin on the next remote operation facility that will service the central part of the city from a site the city purchased in 2007 on North Raleigh Boulevard. Kelly estimates the downtown remote operations facility will cost more than $40 million to build because it will require all new infrastructure and all new buildings. Allen says he has proposed funding of that site using certificates of participation or some other council-approved form of debt, but it has not been approved by the council. We will need to get the results of our bid in order to take the financing package to council, he says. Future phases of the plan include remote operations on Mount Hermon Church Road near Raleigh-Durham International Airport, expansion of the Marsh Creek maintenance facilities, and expansion of the city's Wilders Grove Solid Waste Services facility that opened in January. Travis Brown, the city's Vehicle Fleet Services Supervisor, says the Streets Maintenance Department will be moving about half of its equipment to the Northeast Remote Operations Facility once it's complete, and much of the Parks and Recreation Department's equipment will be moved there as well. Next up, bankruptcy infighting rises as distrust grows among parties. By Chris Bagley from Raleigh. A wave of business bankruptcies since 2010 has led to a growth in related litigation as court officials accuse debtors of diverting funds and creditors scrap over the assets that remain. Known as adversary proceedings, and such litigation can be filed by one party in a bankruptcy against another. Bankruptcy attorneys, including court-appointed trustees who liquidate companies in Chapter 7 to pay off creditors, say the increase in adversary proceedings reflects the growing numbers and size of business bankruptcies. A total of 291 bankruptcies were filed in the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina in 2011, compared to 206 in 2010 and 199 in 2009. Those numbers don't include actions filed under Chapter 13, which is used only by consumer debtors. While some individuals also file under Chapters 7 and 11, adversary proceedings are more common in business bankruptcies because of the larger debts involved. In most adversary proceedings, trustees allege what are known as preferences, says attorney Bill Janver, a former trustee who now mainly represents business debtors. A preference is an otherwise legitimate payment to a supplier or creditor made fewer than 90 days before the company files for bankruptcy. A trustee alleging preference is trying to recover funds and make them available for other creditors. Since the beginning of the Great Recession, we've had a lot of medium-sized businesses file bankruptcies, and larger business bankruptcies spawn a lot of preference actions, Janvier says. Five such actions have come since mid-May in the $26 million bankruptcy of Cecil Technologies. The company was put into bankruptcy in August 2010 by employees who alleged they were owed several thousand dollars in vacation pay. Trustee Joseph Calloway is now suing Progress Energy and four of Cecil's other vendors to recover payments of as little as $9,000. Trustees sometimes go after preferences as small as $5,000. There are few hard and fast rules for which vendors might be sued like that, or how many, says Richard Sparkman, a debtor's attorney who also serves as a trustee. After Mainline Contracting Incorporated of Durham filed a $33 million bankruptcy in September 2009, Sparkman filed a string of 36 preference cases that stretched into June 2011. When you get into preference actions, it truly is an Alice in Wonderland world, Sparkman says. Adversary proceedings can eventually lead to trials, though, as in most other lawsuits, the parties usually settle before that point. Trials are heard by judges without the juries that are available to hear other civic and criminal matters. In a handful of cases, an adversary proceeding is filed by a trustee who has reconstructed the bankrupt company's accounting and found fraudulent transfers to one or more of its owners or other related parties. One such case is that of Guardian of the Grape, a wine importer in Apex that filed for Chapter 7 liquidation in May 2011. Trustee David Dink Warren sued the company's three co-owners last month, alleging that they had taken unfair advantage of the vineyards whose wine they were distributing. The three paid themselves salaries totaling $180,000 using money they were holding for a client vineyard in trust accounts, Warren alleged. Moreover, they paid off a large business loan instead of returning the vineyard's money. The three owners had personally guaranteed that loan and would have been responsible for it even after their company dissolved in bankruptcy, Warren alleged. And now, Why Bank Mergers Are Hot in the Triangle Right Now by Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. Through the purchase of banks and branches, the Triangle market has emerged as the busiest in the state for bank mergers. A new study by Carson Medlin, Monroe Securities, has the Triangle figuring into 4 of the 10 North Carolina mergers and branch deals since June 2011. They weren't necessarily the most lucrative of transactions as far as the sellers were concerned, however. Not included in the study were bank takeovers by private equity groups, including the acquisition of Crescent State Bank by Raleigh-based Piedmont Community Bank Holdings. The takeover of Raleigh-based Capital Bank by a Charlotte investment group was a similar type transaction. Such transactions generally leave the buyer with less than 100% ownership and aren't comparable to whole bank mergers in which one bank acquires all of the stock of another, says Carson Medlin's Steve Huntington. It would be like comparing apples and oranges, he adds. The two Triangle bank-on-bank deals tracked by Carson were PNC Financial's takeover of Raleigh-based RBC Bank of USA and High Point based Bank of North Carolina's acquisition of Durham-based KeySource Commercial, both in early 2012. PNC's purchase price of $3.45 billion was a 97% of RBC Bank's tangible book value. A company's book value is its total debts and liabilities, subtracted from all the monetary assets. Tangible book value refines that result even further by subtracting harder-to-measure factors such as goodwill, patents, and deferred costs. Back in 2008, before the full effects of the financial crisis and economic slowdown, North Carolina banks were selling at 142% of tangible book value. That dropped to 78% in 2011. The five-year average is 96.2%. PNC's purchase price of RBC hit the average. However, Bank of North Carolina's $12 million all-stock acquisition of KeySource was only at 60% of tangible book value. That was the lowest among 15 recent bank mergers in the Southeast, tracked by Carson Medlin, where detailed financial information was available. Bank of North Carolina, BNC, was also the buyer in one of two Triangle branch deals, picking up a pair of former Gateway offices from a Virginia bank. The KeySource and branch deals, once regulators approve, will bring BNC's Triangle's presence to 4 offices. But the High Point Bank hasn't stopped there. In a pair of new transactions, it agreed to pay $35 million in stock and cash to acquire Charlotte-based First Trust Bank, and, in a more recent deal, BNC agreed to take over Charleston, South Carolina-based Carolina Federal Savings Bank in a failed bank transaction. It's all part of BNC's plan to double its total assets to $5 billion with an expanded footprint covering the Carolinas, says Raymond James analyst William Wallace. They are becoming one of the most active consolidators in the state, he says. Next up, after a false start, TheraSim, ready to launch trial program. Durham company forecast clinical trials training program could become primary revenue model. By Lauren K. Alsons. From Durham. AIME, pronounced Amy, is smart for a 9-year-old. She's trained over 150,000 doctors, TheraSim founder David Haddon brags. She, the Artificial Intelligence Mentoring Engine, is a computer simulation program touted as the flight simulator of medicine, about to take on her biggest challenge yet, the clinical research industry. By adding a clinical research training simulation to TheraSim's education software portfolio, Haddon hopes his company will break through the confines of traditional medical training outlets. Medical training is very profitable, he says, but it's not growing. TheraSim has received more than $1 million in equity funding from UK-based Andromeda Capital and booked more than $3 million in revenue in 2011. Haddon speculates that the new clinical training area could comprise 75% of the company's business in the next few years. Some of TheraSim's services are subscription-based, but Hayden anticipates the trial training to be a contracted service. With new clinical trials seemingly starting every day, the possibilities that clinical research offers are endless. TheraSim's new clinical research training simulation allows researchers to practice everything from chart reading to patient selection. It is going into beta testing with a phase 3 trial at a top 5 pharmaceutical company this summer. Hayden would not identify the company. Success there, he says, would lead to other business for TheraSim. Right now, instruction is done primarily through lecture presentation, and there is no one-size-fits-all protocol because each clinical trial comes with its own set of rules designed by the drug company, says John Lewis with the Association of Clinical Research Organizations in Washington, D.C. Research staff would be brought in to go through the protocol, he says, adding that risks and potential side effects and recruitment criteria are among topics discussed before the commencement of a trial. It has to happen quickly, and while there are online programs, some companies want to be extra careful. We have to train people as they come in on a project, says Lisa Zimmerman, Vice President of Clinical Operations at Chapel Hill-based Posen. We assess their level of knowledge for a particular program. Researchers are brought in quarterly for protocol updates at Posen, something Hayden says could be programmed into AIMI. Hayden, a serial entrepreneur who invented the program, doesn't have a college degree or medical background. That's where his team of 18 comes in, people such as Dr. Doug Blevins, who practiced as a clinician for 20 years before joining TheraSim as its medical officer. It demands something of a holistic approach and forces you to look at all the risk factors, Blevins says of AIMI. AIMI, which started out as an AIDS treatment simulator, has been deployed to educate doctors in Africa through a contract with Johns Hopkins University. In the first quarter of 2013, she'll be programmed to train nurses through a partnership with a medical publishing company. And while other applications are forthcoming, Hayden says the clinical research training platform may be the most profitable yet. In 2010, TheraSim President Gordon Cervenka said the clinical trial program would be ready to launch by the end of the year. Hayden says that was an overly optimistic projection. Nearly 2 years and several prototypes later, launch time is near. This week's spotlight is on higher education. This article is entitled Universities Asking Professors to Teach More by Jason DeBruin. From Durham. As budgets in higher education continue to see cuts, university administrators have asked faculty to spend more time in the classroom. At NC State University, for example, tenure and tenure-track faculty taught 203 student credit hours on average in the fall of 2011 semester. That's up more than 15% since 2008, when faculty taught 176 student credit hours. These numbers represent tenure and tenure-track faculty only. Average number of sections taught are up as well. Faculty at UNC Chapel Hill saw a more than 17% increase in that category since 2008. NC Central University has asked its faculty to pick up the most slack of any master's or doctoral granting university, with its faculty teaching twice as many sections as faculty at NCSU and 32% more student credit hours than faculty at UNC Chapel Hill. Given the economic situation, I don't think we have much of a choice, says Jonathan Livingston, professor of psychology at NCCU. That doesn't mean instruction has to diminish, but it does mean the faculty members have to adapt, something that could mean a change in teaching style. It requires you to not lecture, but actually teach, to increase classroom engagement, Livingston says. Students these days are visual learners. If you want to be a good teacher, particularly in large classes, you have to be more visually engaged. In fairness, professors at NCCU perform less research than professors at NCSU and UNCCH. Many of NCCU's research projects, however, involve students, including giving students bylines on academic papers. NC Central has always been a heavy teaching school, Livingston says. If you can do the research and include the students, you get a twofer. A UNC Board of Governors advisory panel that includes NCSU Chancellor Randy Woodson and board members include Ann Goodnight noted that research grant submissions have actually increased 29% in the past 5 years. Even accounting for additional funding from the stimulus bill, awards have increased 4% since last year. To be sure, issues surrounding faculty workload are not new. In fact, at least one faculty workload study dates as far back as 1919. In 1992, Daniel T. Lazell, at the time a fiscal analyst in Arizona, opined in an editorial for the Chronicle of Higher Education that many state policymakers already believe faculty members at public colleges and universities care little about undergraduate education, especially for freshmen and sophomores, where professors often use graduate assistants to teach courses. Even then, he recommended documenting adequate productivity and quality in teaching, research, and public service. More recently, some professors have gone on the defensive about their workload. Professors will spend as little as 6 to 12 hours per week in the classroom and teach 30 weeks a year, a far cry from the 40-hour work week around the calendar for many in other industries. That doesn't mean they aren't working, argues Bruce B. Henderson, a professor of psychology at Western Carolina University. The reality is that many of us spend much of our time on being scholarly, not on producing scholarship, he wrote for the Chronicle on June 11. This week's article, In the Workplace, by Edward Marshall, is titled, Establish a Culture of Trust to Make Business Profitable. Imagine walking into your leadership team meeting wondering whether the same old politics was going to play out. Would the same people work their own agendas again? Would the same people be silent and watch it happen? Would everyone just be nice and kind and not honest and let the meeting pass without ever addressing the elephant, the giraffe, and the rhino in the room? Imagine further that the trust issues were so deep-seated that you begin to wonder if this team would ever be able to be high performance. We know silo thinking, conflict avoidance, a lack of confidentiality, and a lack of accountability play havoc with an organization's efficiency, effectiveness, quality, and bottom line. Now imagine the impact that all of this has on the workforce. Most business leaders today, they don't have time to imagine the scenario. It is how most businesses are led and managed today, large and small. These behaviors usually reflect leadership cultures based on power, politics, or personality, with the results being suboptimal at best. The greatest victim is the loss of trust between individuals, teams, departments, and between senior leadership and the workforce. And yet, we keep working this way. Trust is the one principle of relationships we know we must have to be successful in our own lives, in our teams, and our organizations, and yet it is the most elusive for us. It is an amorphous quality of relationships. We can't touch it, hear it, or see it, but we can feel it. We know when we are trusted and when we trust another. It is hard to attain and easy to lose, and if lost, we may never regain it again. Trust is the icon for our personal and interpersonal integrity. Whether we trust others is the outward reflection of whether we trust ourselves, and when the trust is broken, our ability to forgive others is a reflection of our own ability to forgive ourselves. Distrust in teams, especially leadership teams, can result from our playing by different rules, having different interpretations of events, or have undisclosed expectations of each other or the business. What if we could build and strengthen our levels of trust by agreeing with each other how we will work together? At a level of 100% true consensus, no reservations. What if we created a set of team operating agreements to govern us, how we make decisions, handle disagreements, be responsible for each other and the business, hold ourselves accountable, keep things confidential, and resolve conflicts? What if? Reaching 100% true consensus on how we will work together is hard work. It means we have to subordinate our personal self-interest to the good of the whole. It's not about being right. It's about being in a relationship. It's about becoming a we. But the payoff is we achieve high trust and high performance. It's how we lead our people collaboratively. It's how we become excellent as leaders, as a workforce, and as a business, and never have to ask, what if? This week's guest column is written by Mary Pratt. Ms. Pratt writes for the Boston Business Journal, a sister publication to the Triangle Business Journal. C-suite turnover reaches new highs. More of the world's top public companies replaced their top executive last year than in the past several years. Booz & Company Incorporated's 12th annual CEO succession study found that 14.2% of the world's largest 2,500 public companies replaced their CEOs in 2011. That's a big leap from the 2010 rate of 11.6% and matching the pre-recession averages seen prior to the start of the recent recession. Ken Farvo, senior partner at Booz & Company in New York, says the uptick in CEO turnover suggests that corporate leaders are feeling confident enough in the economy to make a big change at the top, something they often don't want to do when they feel the economy isn't stable. It does signal that boards feel things are stabilizing and they need to think longer term about the leadership of the company, Favaro says. Others are noticing the trend as well. I've seen companies willing to make changes in the last year and a half, and that seems to be more prevalent than in 08 and 09. In 08 and 09, a lot of companies were just looking to hang on and not take on more risk, says Andrew Liezos, who heads the Executive Compensation Group and the Boston Employee Benefits Practice at McDermott Will Emery, LLP. But Ken Martin, a senior partner at the Winter Wyman Companies in Waltham, said the issue isn't clear-cut. I'm not sure I totally agree that the companies tend not to make changes when things are really rocky. It depends on the individual company, Martin says. In fact, with the rapid flow of information today, boards might be pressured to act quickly when there's trouble, regardless of the economy, he said. The market reacts very quickly, so the boards have to move fast, he says. Moreover, Favaro said the 2011 figures, along with the data Booz & Company has been gathering on the topic annually for 12 years, reflects more than simply economic ups and downs. He said the year-to-year changes in CEO turnover, along with why the CEOs are leaving and who replaces them, speaks to various factors, with the economy just one of them. Researchers saw the CEO turnover rate pick up to about 15% 7 years ago, and they attributed the uptick to the increased accountability and responsibility felt by boards regarding CEO performance, an increase stemming primarily from the Sarbanes-Oxley Acts of 2002, Favaro says. According to the Booz & Company succession study, CEOs who departed their positions in 2011 weren't all forced out. Researchers found that 9.8% were planned, 2.2% resulted from mergers or acquisitions, and 2.2% resulted from dismissal. Favaro says the figures showed another notable trend in the C-suite 2011, that more boards were willing to go outside the company to find a replacement. Some 22% of the new CEOs in North America came from outside their organizations, up from 14% in 2007. On the other hand, researchers found that insider appointments outperform CEOs who come from outside the company. Between 2009 and 2011, outgoing insider CEOs delivered on average a 4.4% annual shareholder return above local market indices, compared to an average of 0.5% returns delivered by CEOs who were hired from outside their companies. There seems to be a paradox. Insiders perform better, but there's more outsider hiring. We're not quite sure how to explain the paradox, Favaro concludes. Are you hungry? Biz must have been while searching the web the other day when it stumbled on a website named Stately Sandwiches. It appears that since January of this year, Chicago artist Kelly Pratt has been writing a running blog declaring the most state-appropriate sandwiches across the U.S. She has been adding states as the calendar flips towards 2013 and has North Carolina among her current roster of 12 states. So exactly how does this work? Pratt does research on the internet, calls local sandwich shops, asks foodies on Twitter, and checks out a few books to make sure she properly represents each state, according to her website, statelysandwiches.com. So, what's the word on the Old North State? What sandwich most represents our way of life? Looks like it's the pulled pork sandwich, complete with a mound of pulled pork shoulder, slaw, vinegar-based barbecue sauce nestled between a sesame seed bun. Are you hungry now? Attention Sparians fans, the entertainment venue for adults and family is changing its look to more of a casual sports bar. Sparians, located in Raleigh's North Hills complex, will modify its menu so that more than 80% of the items cost $10 or less. Management is also adding TVs, converting a majority of the tables to high tops, and adding several high-def video and arcade games. GlaxoSmithKline has netted recognition for its commitment to aiding disaster survivors and increasing access to health care. AmeriCares has presented its annual Power of Partnership Award to GSK, a British drug maker with its U.S. headquarters in the Research Triangle Park. AmeriCares says GSK consistently donates medicine in the developing world. By offering our medical experts a choice of medicines, GSK meets some of the most pressing health needs in the world, AmeriCares CEO Kurt Welling says. Since 1989, GSK has partnered with the organization to provide more than $168 million worth of medicines to people in 120 countries, including $252,000 to build a water treatment plant for survivors of the 2009 earthquake in Indonesia. AmeriCares is a nonprofit health and disaster relief organization established in 1982. Small business owners weren't as confident in the economy in May as they were in April, according to a monthly survey conducted by the National Federation of Independent Business. After gaining 2 points in April, NFIB's Index of Small Business Optimism dropped 0.1 of a point in May to 94.5. That's a level consistent with subpar economic growth, according to the NFIB. The index is based on 10 indicators ranging from hiring plans to credit conditions. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is triangleReadingService.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.